Good morning. Welcome to Down to Brass Tacks for this Monday, the second day of March 2020. I'm David Ellis. With me as producer today is Michelle Brathwaite. We expect to go up until 2 o'clock in today's edition of the program, so you can raise with us your concerns and your high points too. We don't just want to hear bad news, good news. There's so much bad news around. We've got all the focus that there is on the coronavirus, also known as COVID-19. You see that it is present now in St. Martin and one of the other countries close to it. And we had this meeting yesterday, an important meeting to establish protocols and to manage the cruise industry in particular in trying to combat this virus. And yet again, I think we've seen some leadership here coming from Prime Minister Motley as chair of CARICOM. It really is good to see the Caribbean community appearing to come together as one on a major issue like this, to properly plan for it, to avoid situations where it seems as though one country is turning away and the other country is saying you can enter, and to come up with a cohesive policy, not only in relation to that, but overall, it seems as though we are in an era where we're going to see more and more of these types of challenges. And we must have this coordinated approach. And therefore, I really think that it is another example of the kind of leadership that we are seeing from Prime Minister Motley within the Caribbean community. It seems as though she has been able to bring some new life and zest into this regional integration movement, largely by the types of relationships that she has been forging with her other CARICOM colleagues. At another level, though, we have other concerns. I'm still here trying to confirm the veracity of a piece of information that has been circulating on social media. It is said to come from the company that is responsible for a couple of restaurants in this country, Chin Chin by the Sea. I think it's Primo Bar and Bistro. That's the one in St. Lawrence Gap. And Hugo's, which was recently opened down there in Spitestown, very close to what we used to call Haywoods and what is now developing into what is called Beaches. Essentially, what this correspondence is saying is that there are some significant challenges facing the people who are in the restaurant business, and that there is some disadvantage that they are facing when you look at the restaurants that are within the hotels. They say in Barbados, it is very easy for the general public to be comforted by the tourism statistics that are quoted. Unfortunately, the increase in arrivals from our airport and seaports has not reflected the revenue spent in our restaurants, and our location are heavily reliant on tourist spending. He went on to say that increased government taxes imposed on tourism-related restaurants, 2.5% increase in VAT, and 2.5% levy imposed in past 2 years. This is an additional 5% on restaurant bills, which, based on the already high cost, pushes the prices up for customers, says this piece. That is why it's essential that we get confirmation that this is indeed coming from the people who it is said to come from. There was no contact number on this information here. But let's deal with the allegations before we get to the messenger. Let's deal with this point here. The wider public may not be aware of a very unfair duty-free concession that is given to restaurants attached to hotels, but not to standalone restaurants. In simple terms, this means that the food is significantly cheaper for hotel restaurants than restaurants which are not attached to hotels such as ours. And this doesn't represent a fair playing field to try and run the business. And in their opinion, says the writer, it is discriminatory. So as we await some kind of both confirmation and reaction to this, let's come to you. This is Down to Brass Tacks. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Ellis. I'm glad I got you on.
Yes, morning.
Morning. Yesterday morning, I happened to decide going up by the others in Woodbourne. I called the transport board about 6:30 and asked them how the bus was running. A lady told me every 2 hours. I hustled up Miss Ellis to get, I got in the bus terminal at 7:30. You know when I get a Yorkshire bus? 9:15. And I caught the Yorkshire bus because I know up there, I know you can walk to the back. But the thing is the lady at transport board that I spoke to, I called her on my cell phone from the terminal and she answered. I said, lady, well, this after 8 o'clock and the bus ain't come. She said, well, that's the schedule. You know, I called her back about 4 times, Ms. Ellis, and she went out. Old ladies waiting to go to People's Cathedral.
How you know she wasn't busy? How do you know that she wasn't called away to something that was urgent?
Well,
on what basis do you come to the conclusion that she saw that you were calling and refused to answer?
The lady
you jumped to a conclusion, or you have good information on which you can come to
the
conclusion?
Well, I jumped to a conclusion, but the lady that I was there with speaking, I had my phone on speaker, so she heard. Conclusion to why can't I come to it?
Because you should know better. I think you interact with people like us here on these calling programs to such a degree that you should know that you need to ask the question why. And before you can say that the person just refused to answer the phone, you might be surprised to discover that there was an emergency situation or something like that.
Yeah, I can agree with you up to a point, because you know you're going to look for the other side. But what I'm saying is, Miss Ellis, is that all I wanted the lady to do, I told the lady, get the people in the terminal to announce on the loudspeaker that where you can get a St. Patrick bus. Or there's a problem. Nothing, so she ain't want to communicate. She told me she was going to do it on the first time she answered my cell phone.
But how many times you called her?
I called her twice. At least she
twice
answered.
Twice that she answered?
She answered twice from my house phone. And then when it got into the terminal, I called and she answered. So I asked her to just announce on the thing when we will get a bus so the people here will know what to do. Half hour after I hear, I called her back, refused. Called back again, refused. 4 times they made it. I tried to get hold of her to find out what was really going on my cell phone now. And no, call the lady that was sitting there with me. She tell me, Marla, why can't the transport board be innovative and say, well, we know people go to church on Sunday morning. So we go a little short bus to the church, not like trying to get people to the church for them to get offerings. But to be honest, this thing is terrible. It's a good thing that I don't go out travel by them buses.
But what you are identifying more than anything else is the consequences associated with the behavior of any one person who is in a position of responsibility. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're a supervisor there, you need to be conscious of the fact that it is important to communicate with people if there is a problem.
Yeah, of course.
If you fail to do that, then you're going to leave the people frustrated and in a state of uncertainty as to exactly what is happening. This is not rocket science. This is simple. This is simple. It is the everyday approach to business that some people in Barbados carry. They got a job, but as far as they're concerned, that job is only to take home some money at the end of the week or the month. I've defended the issue of the person not picking up the phone on the other 4 occasions that you called, saying to you, yes, there's a distinct possibility that they could have been called away.
Of course, I
but
agree with that.
Having said that, What is the excuse for not sharing that information with the public as you had requested? Why not be more sensitive to the fact that there are many different people who will be sitting there waiting for a bus, and that the money that is collected from bus fares, I would believe it helps to pay the person and the people who behave like that. There are a lot of people in this country who carry that kind of attitude. They don't care. They seem to carry a lot of burdens from different things, domestic relationships, children, whatever, the relationships with the other people with whom they work, and they take it out on the public. That's what they do.
But you see, when he heard the Yorkshire bus at 9:15, he told me, you know what I'm saying? I can go to the back. And he went to the back and rambled Miss Ellis.
Called
the door and went up that side from the back road for a long time. That was a good thing I had a freedom out to a lot of bush and grass and things I had to walk.
When is the last time you used that back road?
Huh?
Oh, when is the last time you used the back road?
It says it must have been 30 years.
30 years ago?
Yeah.
You're lucky you didn't fall in a well or something.
No. I don't think so. I know there was a mark. There was a particular house, a farm house. I told myself the road is close to this house. And I tried back. I came back till I get the house. And then I saw the road appear, the track appear that I took it through.
You felt what a sense of relief.
Well, no, I said the relief, because I know if anybody, I wasn't afraid to attack or nothing, because I know he's going to fight.
No, you were just rambling. The point is...
I rambled bad.
How long were you rambling? About 30 minutes?
I rambled for about near 20 minutes. Wow. I tell myself, no, man, that house there, that wall house there, a road above that house.
Okay.
Would you believe that one of my sisters didn't recognize me?
Because you rambled for too long. You look,
no, not rambled
by the time she
long.
Saw you, you must have looked confused.
No, look, confused. She called me by my name, Adjelan, that's you? I say, yeah, there's Adjelan.
And you blame all of this on your transport board?
I blame it on her, because she can't remember. She better.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Down to brass tacks. The notice that I read parts of to you just now, this notice was posted on the webpage of this company called Chin Chin, the restaurant Chin Chin. And somebody else says here to me that they have a friend who works at one of the restaurants, and he told them that he got a call around 6:30 this morning telling him not to come to work, and people who turned up found locks on the doors. So this one is pretty serious, and I sincerely hope that we can get further reaction, especially the government of Barbados and the Ministry of Tourism or the related ministry, because sometimes, you know, they fall between one or the other. Whichever ministry it is, we really deserve to hear some kind of response to this, as they point an accusing finger at the taxation and discriminatory taxation as something that could be affecting the restaurant trade in the country. Welcome to Down to Brass Tacks. Hello.
Hello, David.
Yes, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, morning.
Yes, morning.
I'd like to contribute to the 11 plus debate.
Mm-hmm.
No, I am not in favor. I am not in favor of the abolition of the exam, but I am in favor of the abolition of the purpose for which the exam was serving. No, I also am not giving the minister any high marks for abolishing the exam and not putting anything on the table where the public could discuss, leaving it wide open. I am also in favor of children in the primary school being tested on 3 occasions, at 7, 9, and 11. The purpose of these tests will be to compile profiles on each child, listing their strengths and weaknesses. And in the preceding years, they will work on their weaknesses. The profiles will also accompany the children to secondary school, where the teachers there will be able to work on their weaknesses. Now, I think that children should transfer from primary to secondary school at age 11. And I'm proposing that you use the feeder school system. There's a number of primary schools that will feed into a particular secondary school. And these schools will be feeding 150 students to the secondary school. I'm also proposing that the secondary schools be made, all of them be made sixth form schools and specialty schools. When the primary school children go to the secondary school, they would receive a general education in those schools for 3 years. When they are about to enter fourth form, they would have three options, option one, two, and three, where they would be opting for a specialty school. If at the end of the first year, the teachers see that they are not performing in their option, they would take out option two and probably transfer to another school where option two is being done. If in that year then they're not performing, they would take out option three and go to another school. I'm also proposing that the school leaving age be extended to 18. It doesn't mean that people are going to spend that they're going to be in school to 18. It just means that they have to attend an educational institution. And there will be places like Erdiston College, the Polytechnic, Community College, BIMAC, UE, and so on.
Well, you obviously have given it a lot of thought. Of course, having put your ideas on the table, you know that other people need to discuss them. And you know full well that there are many who are going to have alternative perspectives on that, you know, because there is no easy answer to how you proceed on this particular matter, because there's so many different views that people have, so many different approaches that people can conceptualize. And, you know, as I sit down listening to this discussion, I found it very interesting yesterday when Peter Wickham shared some statistics from some time ago where he made the point that the teachers and the people who are the academics and those who have been better educated are the ones who are calling for the abolition of the 11 plus. But the people who have not been able to get to secondary school and the university are the ones who are clamoring to keep it. And, you know, that's interesting because, I mean, there seems to be a fear factor among those people, but there's also an aspiration that they live with, the aspiration that even though they haven't been able to get it, they expect that if you abolish the 11 plus, their grandchildren or even their children may be the ones who will be denied this opportunity, and they want to hold on to the system exactly as it is. A lot more education needs to go into this whole process. We need to be able to show people to a greater degree the strengths and weaknesses of the local system. Unfortunately, the popular thing to do is just to take off the top and show the performance of the top. And different institutions are responsible for doing that. And if we are to make real progress, we have to be fully conscious of exactly where we are in Barbados and then look for possible solutions to the problem. But the failure rate is too high in the country. And that failure rate is not only in terms of the academics, but in terms of even behavior. So all of that we need to address. Thank you very much. Down to brass tacks. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Ellis.
Yes, morning.
Mr. Ellis, I think the time has come when radio stations have to look at their moderating with view of setting some kind of moderating standards or so, to look at some kind of etiquette for moderating. And I say that against the backdrop that I find that moderators these days, probably even before, like a lot of insulting of the very clients that they have, because they call themselves clients when they call in. You provide the service for us, and we consume it. I find that because you all have the special privilege, you can cut you off, you can do things like that, you hurl a lot of insults at the callers. And I believe that the same way you all don't like people to insult you, you all should not be insulting the callers also. And I can look at a lot of examples, but I can look at the most recent one that infuriated me. Last week, when callers were calling in to debate the abolition of the 11-plus examination, Peter Wickham was the moderator, and he said, you look on the chat, and there were people who disagreed with him. He said, and these clowns on WhatsApp, disagreeing with my position. Now, to me, that should never, ever be allowed to be aired. And the moderators should not be doing this to WhatsAppers or callers. Now, on Sunday, you had Mr. Brooms there, who is also in a disagreement. So this means that Mr. Broom is also a clown, too, because he does not agree with Peter Wickham. And I wonder why you can't have discussions with the public. I leave out the personalities and just deal strictly with the issues. You all have asked us to do it. But then when it comes to you all don't want to do it.
Well, look, you've had a lot to say, and I've listened to you.
Yeah.
But I really think that in general terms, when you listen to this call-in program, I don't think that you can fairly say that across the board and moderators assume an attitude of insulting people. And if you have one example, which you, as far as you are concerned, that is significant enough that you should raise it, I can't quarrel with you in how you interpret that. But to move from there to this position that you moderators across the board are doing this to people, I really don't know that that is so. I think that's blowing it out of all proportion. I will also say this, moderators are people too, and there are scenarios which arise from time to time where we will take positions which are sometimes considered harsh by members of the public. I mean, I sit here from time to time, and you're familiar with bowling and stepping over the crease. You can step over the crease, and yes, we are subject to reprimand by individuals. And when that happens, we have to recognize that, hey, we might have gone too far. And, you know, you moderate, you know, adjust behavior to suit over time. But it is grossly exaggerated for you to pick up the phone this morning because you have had that particular concern and come here and paint all the moderators with the same brush. I don't accept it. It is not true.
You said, Mr. Ellis, in the beginning that you need moderating standards. I meant other things as well. And that is not the only example.
Well, let me say something to you.
Yes.
I hold the view that when people come to the brass tacks to discuss matters of national interest, we do not really enhance this program by sitting down and talking about how the program is run. I have this same position with some other callers who have from time to time felt that this is the opportunity to come and say, this is right with the program and that is wrong with the program. And I say to you all, I have a number. where you can call me and discuss these things off the air. I mean, let me say that I've heard your complaint so far.
I didn't finish, you know.
And that's why I tell you, I ain't letting you finish here. Okay. If you want to say more about the program, I think you and I could discuss this off the air. But I'm not fair to other members of the public and listeners when I'm going to put them through this kind of examination, as distinct from all the other things that they want to talk about. You can talk to me off the air. I give you the assurance that I will listen to you. I may agree with you, I may disagree with you. But at the end of the day, you have that opportunity rather than trying to turn Brass Tacks into an examination of itself. Okay? Thank you very much. This person writes that it was evident that Chin Chin and Hugo's were suffering for a while with their low numbers. Why is it that businesses tend to blame the government when they can't admit that their own are part and parcel of the reason behind their failure? Why is it that in the same environment, Tides and Champers remain competitive? These restaurants continue to remain popular among locals and tourists as they adjust to their environment. The person goes on to say that they happened to be in Champers for lunch yesterday and they'll be at Tides next Sunday, and also often find themselves at Savannah for lunch during the week. Why? Because I'm able to go and enjoy all that these restaurants have to offer in terms of ambiance and food at reasonable rates. Well, that's one side of it, but you still have to come to terms with the charge that part of the problem that the standalone restaurants are facing is that the restaurants in the hotels are getting a better deal than they are. Is that true? You haven't addressed that particular aspect of it. I can't quarrel about the concern you raised about management and decisions, because it is quite possible that they can and do play a critical role. I mean, the very decision that you make to open up a new restaurant in a very, very difficult climate is one that you have to live with, and you cannot blame it all on government taxes. But you knew what the playing field was like, generally speaking, when you actually went into the business. This is Down to Brass Tacks. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, hello?
Hey, good morning, Mr. Ellis. How are you?
I'm well. How about you?
Same old soup boy, just warm over.
Mm-hmm.
This is my first call in quite a while, so at the same time, let me tell you Happy New Year, and I wish you the best for 2020.
Same to you and yours.
Good, good. Now, just to jump straight into the point, I would have been made aware of maybe a contribution sometime last week or a week before, where we were made, where we were sensitized about the ongoing plans to roll out up to 3,000 solar PVs in Barbados in alignment with the national energy policy. Now, I just want to say that I'm in total agreement with that potential approach. It sounds like a viable business model. And for that, I want to commend the efforts of both, I can call them by name because it's nothing bad, Mr. Mark Hill and James Brown from BNOCL, two persons that I know who are putting that initiative and have a good grasp of their respective disciplines. However, you know, I also want to advance the discussion about Barbados's overall transition way beyond putting solar PVs on roofs, and just ask that we think outside the box about the larger implications in the transition. Because in fact, by my estimate, if we had to put all 3,000 solar systems, not panels, on the roof, let's say between 2 to 2.5 kilowatts per system, it means that it will only represent roughly 2.5% of the overall $10 billion that is required to transition us straight into the 2030 fossil fuel-free framework. I think by and large, we recognize, or we ought to recognize, that the transition is far more than just putting solar panels on rooftops. And I commend the effort and think it's a viable business proposition. But based on the numbers before me, I think we need to merge the notable business acumen with perhaps some social and environmental considerations at every stage. And on that point, I do recommend that we focus more on the waste disposal and recycling aspect when it comes to the transition. So there are three things that I would like to propose. One, that we establish a facility or facilities that are dedicated to the materials of the renewable energy equipment, not just solar. This has implications perhaps in the recycling.
Your call is breaking up a bit. As a result,
sorry.
Some of your words are, we're missing some of your words.
My bad. But I just really wanted to get 3 points in. Can you hear me more clearly now?
I hope so. You proceed.
Good. Right. So I just wanted to propose that we establish a facility that is dedicated towards recycling the materials from the renewable energy equipment. Secondly, I wanted to make it mandatory for all companies, including statutory corporations that are involved in RE, to develop waste management plans that speak to the obligation of repurposing the various components. And thirdly, I hope that we can make it mandatory for Barbadian companies and statutory corporations that import RE panels or RE components to purchase them from manufacturers that have a waste management strategy as well. And I understand that to upset this type of regulation means that the panels that you're importing may be more expensive. But picture this. Picture having to import from someone who has their own waste disposal policy that they'll come and collect the panels and all the components from you afterwards. It means that we are dumping less in Barbados as well. So by and large, I think that I support the overall push towards RE. I support all of the different movements towards solar and whatever else you're looking at, biofuel and stuff. But I think that we need to balance it and ensure that once we're transitioning to fossil fuel-free and reducing the carbon emissions, that we're not increasing the amount of waste within Barbados at the same time.
You know, very few people have raised that. You know, all you ever hear about is the push to RE, as you call it.
Yeah.
But this waste disposal and recycling component is virtually ignored in public discourse.
Yes, it is.
And I really think that based on what we are seeing with the tires in particular across there at the landfill, this helps to reinforce the concern about how we are actually dealing with waste disposal going forward towards the future, because we already have a major problem.
Yeah.
I think we long recognized from the days that we were talking about putting a landfill at Greenland, we long recognized that we had a problem. Now, I must tell you that there are a couple of things that I have seen come back to the fore with this new Barbados Labour Party administration. One of them has been the resurgence of the idea of the botanical gardens, for example.
Yes.
Now, there was something else recently that it struck me was a continuation of an idea that was mooted some time ago. This same 11 plus discussion is a carryover from what was taking place years ago.
Mm-hmm.
One question, therefore, for the administration is this.
Mm.
Have they completely put paid to the idea that they put on the table years ago with respect to garbage disposal when it came to the controversial issue of Greenland? Remember, a station was placed there as well that is still unoccupied, basically, has not been used. So, I mean, my question would be, is the silence that we are getting on this issue perhaps a signal of what is likely to come? Because, I call all the time for the minister responsible for the environment to lay out before the public of Barbados a plan of action that includes the very point that you are raising here. But you can, this is something that we don't raise this out of mischief. We raise this out of a genuine concern, because we know only too well, based upon what has been discussed in the country, that this is a problem.
And don't think that this is something that hasn't been addressed by other countries, because in the European Union there's something that they call PP cycle, which requires requires the persons purchasing from manufacturers to purchase from those manufacturers that have a sound and compliant waste management system. And I think for that reason that's where you may find there are certain manufacturers in China and other countries that may not necessarily qualify in terms of making exports to Europe as well, because if they don't have a waste management policy saying that by the next 20 years or so, we can actually retain a lot of the components from you, we can repurchase it from you, then they don't qualify to actually participate in the market. And this is something that we should look at as well. Just one more point before we run. I'm not intending to have a long discussion on it, but I hear a lot of discussion about the Lavin Plus. I don't have the magic bullet, but I think it's very interesting because my wife is Jamaican, and it's very interesting to look at their system, not to adopt it, whoever looks at it, but it's interesting that their Lavin Plus is really stretched over 2 years, which may be the equivalent of Class 3 and Class 4. So you don't necessarily wait until the last minute and scramble and do one exam, but you are assessed based on those final 2 years in the primary system, primary education system. And I'm not making a proposal to all the scholars because we have more than enough scholars that know all these things about education and stuff, but I just find it quite interesting.
Well, you know, the question of best practice, so to speak, within the region is something that we're not discussing either. Who yeah. else is doing it differently in the Caribbean community? I know that there was some reference to Finland, but Finland is way off base because of its, you know, the social welfare system in Finland is considered to be superior to anything that we have here. The number of weeks that a person gets for maternity leave in Finland, for instance, is significant.
You know, we have a tendency in the Caribbean to make comparisons to countries that are doing worse when we are doing bad, and comparisons to countries that are doing very well, sometimes when we don't have a solution as well.
Yeah.
So if something bad happens in Barbados, they may tell you, look at Haiti. If something good, really good happens in Barbados, they may tell you, look at Haiti again. So sometimes we tend to select scenarios with respect to countries just to suit our particular situation. But I just say that to say, I take your point that, you know, you can't compare apples to oranges because there are totally different dynamics between here in Finland and here in England and here in Norway as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. A couple of people have taken me up offline here, off the air, on this whole question of the attitude of moderators to people on this show. And the truth is that I don't believe that any useful purpose is served by spending a lot of time on the show itself talking about that. Having said that, though, do not believe for 1 minute that we are not concerned that we don't overstep the crease too much in communicating with people on the program. Each moderator will have his or her style. But I remain firmly of the view that it is not an across-the-board situation where this offensive attitude that some of you are talking about prevails. And that in instances where it comes to the fore, that I think we all are conscious of the fact that we are here talking about standards and that sort of thing, and we are expected to live up to certain standards as well. But what useful purpose is going to be served this morning by converting this program into a discussion about moderators and their styles and their approaches? I really don't think that I should encourage that kind of discussion here at this time, given the fact that the program really ultimately is about the concerns of people. And I'm going to say this too. Sitting here, it is really unfortunate the many times that you can find yourself being the subject of abuse and bad behavior from callers. And when you have to put your foot down on it, you are the person who is considered the bad person. Nobody talks about their attitude, you know. It is all about the moderator. So I've been here long enough to know that. Now, there's some other concerns here. People are complaining about some trucks that are ferrying materials. They say this is material from the flour mill site to the airport for regrading the runway. And the complaint is that too many people are overloading these trucks and littering the streets with the stones all along the route that they travel. If you look at the main highway, for instance, going to the airport, you will see a lot of that gravel on the side of the road. I thought that it was an offense to overload. I really thought that that's been a matter of real concern for quite some time. And People who are ferrying that kind of material are expected to cover the lorries properly. But unfortunately, sometimes this is what you see. When the private sector is involved in it exclusively, there's one standard for private sector interests, but when the state is involved, it is a completely different matter. And I hold firmly to the view that the state can be grossly unfair in the double standards that it sets, and then it expects other people to follow what is considered to be the rule or the law, when even if it is not the law, morally it is expected that the state will follow a particular line. Now, I know that there's been a lot of discussion about common entrance. As I said last week, and I still feel very strongly, I do not understand how we can be properly discussing this subject without more information. And people have had a traditional response to it, because some people hold on to this view that, you know, if you abolish common entrance, the sky is going to fall. And therefore, they emotionally say, no, I don't want that. That's not good for us. The other has to do with the limited discussion to some extent that there has been. I mean, the weekend conference we've had with the Prime Minister talking about COVID-19 and the steps that are being taken, the fact that we've been able to bring Carnival, the CEO of Carnival, to that meeting to embrace the private sector in the discussion. That is commendable, that is significant. And overall, we are in a situation today where I think many people in the country are a little bit jittery. I mean, the very fact that it is being said that it is inevitable that it will get here, it scares people, but it will scare the elderly more than anything else, because what you have heard suggests that people who are over 80 and those people who are troubled by chronic diseases are the ones who have to fear this issue more. Why is it being discussed so much, though, you may ask? Because some people are looking at the mortality rate, and the projected mortality rate from this virus is not really high. But what is the real factor is the fact that you have some element of the unknown associated with it. And once you are into the unknown, people will be worried. Now, the public discussion on this has to be responsible, especially when you are dealing with social media, and some of the stuff that I've seen on social media so far has been pretty troubling, in the sense that people pick up any and every piece of information and peddle it and give the impression, you know, that, you know, this situation is really worse than it is. So you have to be very careful. First of all, I would strongly recommend that unless you have a pretty firm view that the information that has been sent to you is correct, refrain from just sending it out to any and everybody. Because some part of that is just to throw people into a state of panic. This is Down to Brass Tacks. Hello?
Morning.
Yes, sir.
How are you this morning?
I am well, and you?
I'm fine, Mr. Harris. Good morning to you, and good morning to our listeners. Greetings.
Yes, morning.
Ellis, there was a gentleman who called our program. I saw our program last night. His name is Rod. And he'd be relentless with his toward the landfill. I would like to support Rod this morning. Because I had a situation that I see that I wonder why this thing's much garbage into Barbados. A refrigerator came home.
Mm-hmm.
It came in a box. It had 8 pieces of cork. 4 at the top, plastic. Then his face got on plastic. He said his face, all his shelves got on paper or plastic or that. A lot of rubbish and paper. I asked myself, important garbage, you know? I mean, Miss Ellis, all that stuff got to go to the landfill. I mean, it's amazing, you know. I just cannot, and what you know, to make matters worse, the instructions come in a foreign language. You can imagine that? You can't read the instructions. No, I can't speak the foreign language. Nothing in English, so that rubbish alone.
Well, these days it isn't that difficult to get it translated, though, you know.
Yeah, no, I know that.
It's easier to get it translated.
Yeah, but that's the big
point. But you know, you have to talk to me. You take one element of it. But what about the whole picture of garbage disposal in the country? I mean, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, it won't look into Mr. Ellis, because to be honest with you, sir, we've around the space to put garbage, so we need to do some recycling. You know, separation. And
are we ready for that? When you look at how Barbadians actually dispose of garbage and deal with things like that, are we really ready for it?
Ellis, might be behind the eight ball. Listen, like I said something to you, Mr. Ellis. In 1977, right, I was 16 years old. 78, sorry, I was 17. I went to California to work on a ship. And a gentleman came to the ship and he asked me, what we used to do with, we know, I don't know, beer, we used to do with all the beer cans. I tell him, I just go over the site, which is overboard. The man tell me that saved them for me. When I start saving these cans, just put them in the bag and pack them up. I'm standing, we used to go up to Canada and come back. No, that's about an 11-day trip. I'm standing about six big garbage bags of beer, aluminum cans, you know, and they give them to the man, you know. And I wonder what he was doing with them. I don't really ask that question.
But what for all of the talk that we put down, what motivates a person to go and take a mattress and pelt it, say, the road, or a fridge? What is causing that?
That's one I can't get comprehend. I just can't figure it out like that. Listen, you go up there, like then, just when you go up Green Hill, and turn left to go to Whitehall. When you walk, you just look over the gully there. And that's the whole scenario, you know, Mr. Ellis. I pass there, then I look over and see a fridge door in there. A mattress. And this is not in the country, you know, my brother. This is just when you go up Green Hill, up from Spawner Center, make the left turn, to across Whitehall Road to KFN. Right there up on the left-hand side. And houses out there, man. And I do not know why people... I don't like to see people literally. I can't take it.
You know, somebody called me this morning and said, but you know, with all of this talk about the coronavirus and stuff, there are some practices that they're seeing from Barbadians that really makes you wonder if they understand the seriousness of this situation and how there has to be some change in their behavior, especially in public. And it makes you wonder if that particular virus gets here, how will people modify behavior? I shudder to think a lot of people are still behaving as though, look, it is no problem, it is no issue. And it is relevant to not just one, but a whole set of infectious diseases that we will have to be dealing with. I mean, we've battled with some in the past that didn't get here, things like Ebola and all of that. But, you know, for some people, there has got to be a significant change in the way that they behave in public. Are they ready? Are we ready for that?
Mr. Ellis, that's my belief about Barbadians. They've got some Barbadians, right, that never left this island yet and went nowhere. So they just believe that nothing they can do, Barbadians, nothing. I they do not understand that. They never leave Barbados and went overseas where they had to abide by rules and regulations. Mm-hmm. We're so much accustomed to a carefree attitude down here in this island that I do. They like attitude that they find it hard
well
to apply.
This person says that 56,000 people die from the influenza virus, and no one seems alarmed at that. But you know what? Whenever the flu season comes around here, it spreads like wildfire. And it spreads like wildfire because we don't indulge in the practices that we ought to. I mean, so if that happens with the flu, what happens with something that is potentially more serious? Now, you may want to make the comparison between the flu and coronavirus, but tomorrow it could be something else. It is a question of, isn't this a wake-up call for how we deal with ourselves and how we interact with our neighbors and that sort of thing, and the kind of hygiene that we practice? I think it is. This is Down to Brass Tacks. Thank you, sir.